donuts. Is there anything they can't do?
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to the bunker, everybody. Ho, ho, ho. It's Thursday evening, and it's April the 6th, 2006. I started to say 1985. Have been a good year for me.
It was a good year for me, too. But it's not the current year. It's 2006. We're muddling through tonight. I'm sniffling and snorting, and Sharon is suffering from carbohydrate deprivation. And we're just going to kind of muddle along here tonight. So if we kind of hit a couple of bumps in the road, be forgiving because we're operating at less than full capacity. No complaints. So I'm sure there are plenty of people in this world that would gladly trade whatever we got for whatever they got. So.
You know, I bet they would. We don't get sick very often. It's been a long time since I've had a cold, too. And I hope I'm not getting yours. I love you, honey, but keep your cold to yourself.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm just happy to share.
I know, but that's my thing. See, my name's Sharon.
Well, tonight we've got first part of a two-part archive interview. More classic PID tonight as we bring you an interview we did about a year ago with Dr. Michael S. Heiser. And he'll talk about the connections, the academic reasons that we can connect the fallen angels with the modern UFO phenomena.
Yeah, you know what? He is so amazing. He, in some ways, he approaches the subject from a very dry way.
Mm-hmm.
It's because he is very studious.
Right.
And when he makes a statement, you can bet he has looked at every angle of that subject before he makes that statement.
Right. There are some in the ufology community who would like him to go further out on a limb than he does. But it's good that he doesn't because he keeps those who read his words and hear his words intellectually and academically honest. So that's why we value his information so highly. And as we mentioned last night, we highly recommend his monthly newsletter, which is a steal at $10 a year. Mm-hmm. It really is. It really is. Got a couple of things to catch up on. We did want to mention a little follow-up from last night. We offered some opinions about the flap in Washington, D.C. with Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. And a couple of folks pointed out that we should give her credit for some of the good work that she's done. And they're right.
I totally agree with that. I wasn't even aware that she was on the 9/11.
She chaired a Citizens 9/11 right. Commission, sort of an inquest, and helped to lend some credibility to a proceeding that got some information, some very valuable research into what happened on September 11th, 2001, into the public arena.
Mm-hmm.
She's also, as a member of Congress, really gotten into the face and challenged the administration on some things, like the missing trillions of dollars in the Department of Defense budget,
yes.
The trafficking in humans by DynCorp and other contractors of the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's conceivable that there are people within the administration who are really happy to see the trouble that she's gone through these last few days.
You know, you and I were talking yesterday about how we didn't think that she handled it right. And I'll be honest, based on how it was described,
mm-hmm.
if indeed what happened is that she was stopped because she was trying to go past the guard, she had no ID mm-hmm. on that he could see. And he just wanted to make sure that she knew she couldn't do that and find out who she was and why she was running past him.
Mm-hmm.
If that's really what happened, then I think that her reaction at that point was, you know, it was inappropriate. I really do think that. And I'm really glad she apologized for it today. But mm-hmm. however, I started thinking about this today, and I want to thank the people who wrote to us because, you know what, we really do try to look at all sides of an issue. We mm-hmm. don't. We try really hard not to be partisan. We try to be apartisan, if anything else. I guess if we're partisan about anything, it's because it's Gilbert. We can't help being who we are and having the opinions we do. But we do try to look at all sides. And even as we look at all sides, I started thinking about this today and wondering, is it possible, given the good work that this woman has done, is it possible that she was set up?
Possibly.
Now, I know that that's really conspiratorial, but if for whatever reason she was set up, then I think it stinks. But anyway,
yeah.
Kudos to her for apologizing.
Kudos for apologizing, right, because the bottom line is that it's never a good idea to strike an officer of the law.
No, I don't think so. Well, my nephew's a police officer. You know, we've got lots of police officers in our families. And I take that very seriously.
Right.
Well, enough said about that.
Yeah. I, as long as we're talking about people in service, especially those who are protecting us, we got an email from a gentleman who listens in Bosnia yesterday, a 22-year veteran of the Air Force. And he sent a note based on an email that's been circulating, which was prompted by an op-ed piece written for the Washington Post.
Now, actually, we got that email a few days ago, and we've been remiss and not...
Right.
We haven't mentioned it until now.
Yes, exactly. And so we did. I sent him a note this morning and let him know that we would talk about it tonight. It was written by Cindy Williams. Now, the email that's going around, and I did a little checking on this, identifies the writer, the author of the op-ed piece, as Cindy Williams, the actress who starred in Laverne and Shirley.
Ah, yeah. I wondered if it was the same Cindy Williams.
It's not. It's not. This is a person who was a research associate in a congressional office and a graduate of MIT. It's a different Cindy Williams.
Mm-hmm.
The email also identifies the original article as appearing in the Washington Times, and it appeared in the Washington Post. Okay, just a couple of little facts to want to clear up. The article, which complained that military salaries were increasing too quickly and that the servicemen and women who received the pay increase didn't deserve them, appears to be accurate. It's just they identified the wrong person. As far as we know, Cindy Williams, the actress, has no problem with members of the military. Okay?
We just want to make that clear. Well, she hasn't said anything, so we don't know.
As far as we know. But we do want to point out that there's a response to this op-ed piece that's been circulating in this email, written by an airman, apparently, named Bragg.
And you'll put a link to this.
Yes.
This content.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can read it for yourself. The airman's piece was very well written and makes the point that people in the military, especially those on the front lines who are suffering the greatest risks, and we also add the highest exposure to things like experimental vaccines and depleted uranium munitions, are doing so for a salary that is far below what many of them could be earning in the private sector, and are often doing it while they're separated from their families, their wives and children, for many, many months at a time. Hardships that I certainly wouldn't want to put up with. I mean, that's one reason I don't want to travel, for example, take a job where I have to travel a few days a week even. I like being home. I like being here with you.
I like it when you're here.
So we wanted to point that out, and we thank the gentleman in Bosnia for forwarding that to us and calling that to our attention. Because as we've mentioned before, while we have some questions, some very serious questions about the way our military is being used, we truly do respect and support the men and women, and especially those young men and women, some of whom now are, still young enough. They could be our kids. We really, really respect their volunteer. Well, and again, it's an issue
could be my grandkids,
really strikes close to home, because our daughter's getting to an age where in a year or two she could be volunteering if she chose.
Yeah.
So the way the military is being used is now suddenly becoming more real to me than it was even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's move on. We had a couple of other quick points here. I saw a story that you posted to Watcher Magazine a couple of days ago that I thought was really interesting, and we didn't talk about it. It's about researchers in DARPA who are building an army of insects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I mentioned this once before. This is so much like a science fiction short story I read in which insects were integrated with circuit chips and recording devices to be used as spies.
Yeah.
Little recording cockroaches, recordo roaches, and it's really bizarre, but apparently this is really in the works at DARPA, where they are trying to integrate electronics with insects in the larval stage, hoping that they will then be integrated into the bodies of these insects.
They're turning them into little Borg.
Yeah, yeah, insect Borg.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is to use these to sniff out landmines, where they can be fitted out with sensors, I guess, that detect the electronic signatures of landmines or just sense the presence of metallic objects or something. But you just know that sooner or later, somebody's going to say something in the privacy of a men's room or women's room somewhere with a little cockroach sitting by with his antenna that are more than just, you know, little antenna.
Wait a minute. That mosquito that I saw earlier was awfully big.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are a couple of stories that I've got in, that I posted today that I would really like to bring up. And, and two of them are from the same site, from linuxelectronics.com.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
You know what? These are really interesting, and I'm going to start haunting that site every day to see what's up there, because there are some really on-the-ball people posting stories. One is about Google Desktop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Google is seeking to become sort of an omnipresence on your computer.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, Google Desktop actually, if you don't set up your preferences correctly, will copy your hard drive and make it searchable by anybody on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, your hard drive is supposedly password protected when you set this up, but we all know that enterprising hackers, or perhaps people at the NSA.
Well, and I think you also have to enable, you know, the search. I think there are probably parameters so that love letters or you know, whatever aren't included. This really stinks.
Yeah. It basically, if you set up a certain feature with Google Desktop called Search Across Computers, it will copy all of your document files, PDFs, Word documents, spreadsheets, any other text-based document will be copied to a big server at Google so that you can basically access it from any computer. So if you've got a work computer and a home computer, sometimes it's a hassle remembering which documents are where and making sure that you've got them in the right place. However, by putting it up on someone else's server, you're also potentially making it accessible to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is the deal.
And you know, password protect everything, folks. Don't assume that no one is going to be interested in looking at your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody will want to look at your computer for no other reason than to use it, you know, as a weapon in a denial of service attack or something.
Yeah.
Another one that came from linuxelectronics.com is about how AT&T is forwarding internet traffic to the NSA.
Mm-hmm. I think this was rumored, excuse me, sometime back.
Well, but apparently it's part of a lawsuit. Yeah.
Yeah, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a group that really champions internet privacy and personal privacy in the electronic age, has filed a lawsuit against AT&T. And the evidence that they're presenting, they say, supports their claim that AT&T is diverting internet traffic through servers at the NSA. Isn't that frightening? AT&T's got a pretty big chunk of the broadband market.
You know, it doesn't have to just be chips and things, folks.
Mm-mm.
Or dip. It can be, oh, chips. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you know what? They are spying on us. There is, in fact, Bush had a conference today, and he was asked by someone in the audience, will you apologize for having the NSA spy on the American people? And he said, no.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm doing this to keep us safe. I'm not going to apologize for that.
Yeah. Besides, Clinton did it. My dad did it.
Exactly.
Carter
well,
did
I
it.
Mean,
Reagan did it. Nixon did it.
Plus everybody. George Washington did it.
Yeah. It's yeah, as we talked about the other day, and I put a link to Dave Emery's website in the show notes for his program that he did a couple of weeks ago, which is called For the Record, in which he pointed out and documented that this has been going on for over 40 years. It's only coming out now because the intelligence community is trying to strike back at George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, George W. probably feels that he's got no reason to apologize because he's being targeted by the intelligence community. And it's something that's been going on for the last 40 years. Why should he have to apologize for
it's
it?
It's really interesting to watch it all happen, though, because of the infighting that's going on in it. And Tom Horn talked about this yesterday. So if you haven't listened to that, no. Wasn't Horn. It was Steve Quayle.
Steve Quayle talked about it.
Yesterday. Yes. Yes. So listen to that archived show from yesterday on the Steve Quayle. Boy, do we have time for one more thing? Because we're going to have to go to the interview.
Sure.
If you're wondering where all your money is, it's in China.
Oh.
They have $850 billion.
$850 billion.
They've got a lot of dollars.
Well, yeah, they are holding on to a lot of American currency. They've been buying up T-bills and just stocking the U.S. currency away.
You know, you and I have talked about this for some time. It just really hit me today how much they have. They're now the number one reserve holder for U.S.
I heard somebody speculate on another talk show the other day that the reason that Iran did not proceed with its oil bourse on the 20th of March, as was originally scheduled, is because the Chinese, possibly, went to Tehran and said, look, let us dump a few of these dollars first.
Oh, you know, that's entirely possible.
Because,
you know, they need oil,
mm-hmm.
and they'd like to buy it in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And once they don't have any dollars, but they're rich in euros,
mm-hmm.
or they, whatever.
Or at least they'd like to exchange the dollars for something else. Yeah, if dollars for euros, dollars for gold, dollars for silver, or
donuts.
Whatever.
Dollars for donuts.
Dollars for donuts. That could
yes.
be. Yes. Yeah. So it will be interesting to see what happens. Of course, the oil bourse is still scheduled to take place sometime in the next year, but we don't know when now. Mm. And it could be that there's something going on back channel that kind of put that off.
Well, enough blathering for today. You know what? About a year ago, we had a fantastic interview with Dr. Michael Heiser, and you guys get to hear it either for the first time or you're hearing it again. And I'm betting that if you're hearing it again, you're going to think, oh, I missed that the first time. Did he say that the first time?
Mm-hmm.
I know I always do that when I listen to the archived shows. So here's part one with Dr. Michael S. Heiser.
Dr. Michael Heiser. Mike, we sure appreciate you being with us.
Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Your study is focused on the divine counsel. And, well, in a nutshell, could you just give us an overview? What is the divine counsel?
Okay. In simplest terms, the divine counsel is made up of God and his heavenly host. Now, what people usually think when you hear that is God and the angels, but there's a lot of terminology in the Old Testament in Hebrew and in other languages that match Hebrew, and even in the New Testament as well, that relays the much more developed hierarchy. In other words, there are terms for different divine beings. I'll use the phrase divine beings, by the way, a lot, just to sort of catch all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are differences in terminology that really help you parse out the hierarchy of the heavenly host. It's not just God and angel. Angel is a term in Hebrew. It's malach, which just means messenger.
Right.
You know, for lack of a better term, the divine gopher, divine angel. They're sent on specific missions, and they do what they're asked to do. And, you know, they're naturally superior to humans. But within the what we call the divine council, and it's a term that's well-known in biblical scholarship as far as people who do Semitic languages, people who just read their English Bible may or may not get it from different passages, and we can talk about those passages
right.
in their English translations. But anyway, within the council there are other Elohim, which kind of shocks people, because a lot of English Bible readers will know that Elohim is one of the names for God.
Right, right.
So when you start talking about other Elohim, it's like, oh, this is kind of freaky. Is this polytheism? You know, what is this?
Right. This is something that we've been trying to grapple with. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. The textbook place that you find this, you know, just point blank in a literal English translation, but in Hebrew, it's just very obviously is Psalm 82. And the first verse of Psalm 82 says, literally, God, and the word there is Elohim, stands in the divine assembly. Hebrew there is Ba.el. It could be assembly of El, which is also another name for God, or it mm-hmm. could just be divine assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, in the midst of the Elohim, he passes judgment. So the first Elohim, the same word occurring twice in the same verse, first Elohim has to be singular because, sorry to bring up grammar, the nasty G word. The first Elohim has to be singular because the verb is singular. God stands. If anybody's had any languages out there, they know that there's this thing, person and number associated with different
right.
words.
Right, deer and deer, for example.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You can't tell whether our English word deer or a word like fish or sheep,
mm-hmm.
you can't tell whether I'm talking about one or more than one.
Right.
Until I put it in a sentence and give it context. And a lot of the time, what really tips you off is the verb.
Mm-hmm.
If I say, I saw the deer, you have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. If I say I saw the sheep, you have no idea. If I
mm-hmm.
if I put sheep in a different word or a different sentence, like the sheep is lost,
right.
then you know I'm talking about one.
Exactly.
Because of the verb. If I say the sheep are lost, you know I'm talking about more than one.
Right.
The same thing in Hebrew. You have this kind of thing going on. So in Psalm 82, verse 1, first Elohim is singular. The second one has to be plural because it's preceded by the preposition in the midst of. You can't be in the midst of one.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Good point.
So it has to be plural. So right there you have in the biblical text, and you know I certainly think the scriptures are inspired, so I'm gonna go with what it actually says.
Hmm.
I'm not going to try to camouflage it. Right there,
mm-hmm.
you have a statement that God, the God of Israel, Elohim proper name, is sort of presiding or passing judgment in this context over the other gods.
Mm-hmm.
Now from that point on, you have certain decisions to make about what this could mean. A lot of people say, well, that must be the Trinity. Well, that doesn't work in Psalm 82 because the other gods are being condemned for being corrupt, and they're actually told they're going to die like men.
Right.
So, you know, it just doesn't work. You can't call Jesus, you can't call the Son and the Spirit corrupt and have God sentencing them to death for crimes that they've committed or not measuring up to God's standards.
Sure.
It does
okay.
not work. You know, you go to other passages where there are plurals, like, let us make humankind in our image.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the only verse you had in the Bible that had plurals like that, yeah, you know, I guess the Trinity could work there. But
right.
the thing is, you want something that works everywhere you have divine plurality.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not, the Trinity just doesn't cut it as far as being an explanation for what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, well, these must be human judges.
That's the explanation I've heard, yes.
Right. That what makes that especially odd is you have, again, if these are human judges, they're corrupt human judges, okay, because they're getting judged in the passage
mm-hmm.
for being, you know, not doing their job and being evil and wicked. And
right.
partial and so on and so forth. Well, why would we call evil corrupt human judges? In verse 6, they're called the sons of the Most High.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an incongruity there because you think if they're believers or godly, they wouldn't be getting condemned like this. The second incongruity is that God says to them, hey, in verse 6, I said you were gods, and you're all sons of the Most High, but you're going to die like men.
Right.
So why would he tell a human being he's going to die like a human being?
That's sort of a given, right?
Duh.
Right. Duh.
it doesn't make either the writer or God sound too bright at that point. And again, if this were the only passage, if it was only Psalm 82, you know, maybe there would be some argument there. I don't think there is, just by those two contextual indicators.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you want try to take it somewhere else, like, you know, Exodus 15:11, where after they get to the Red Sea, the song of Moses, you know, O Lord, who is like you among the Elim, among the gods?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Lord, who is like you among the human judges? Well,
that doesn't quite
exactly
fit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks
yeah.
for that big pat on the back. it just doesn't make any sense. It really lacks explanatory value
mm-hmm.
for a number of instances. But the thing that gets me, you know, other than you know, you can go again to the English Bible and ask people logical questions. Does this make sense to you? And you know, once they think about it, no, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But on a more academic footing, when you go into Semitic languages, you start to see, especially with the language like Ugaritic, which is from ancient Syria, which, as we know from modern politics, is Israel's next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient people who lived there, their language, which has been known since the late 20s, is the closest language to Hebrew that you get in the ancient world. And they have the exact same phrases.
Hmm.
Sons of God, divine counsel. Their chief god was El, the
mm-hmm.
same as, you know, same word as in the Hebrew Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You start seeing the same kind of counsel, heavenly host language. And, you know, you start to realize that, well, you know, we wouldn't want to say that this the people over here, who, if you read their material, are obviously polytheists. They're not going to say that their human judge is there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, we can't use that argument there. They don't believe in a trinity there. So then that creates the question, well, how do we handle this in the Hebrew Bible? And what the Hebrew Bible usually does, it's well known for taking things like a belief in the divine council. There's a lot of common belief in the ancient world in different subjects, and the relationship of God to the gods, to angels, and whoever else is mm-hmm. involved in the heavenly hierarchy. That's a question that every civilization had. But oftentimes you'll get the Israelite version of this in the Bible that looks either, in some cases, identical or with slight changes made. And the changes are the most interesting part, because what they often do is they'll take something well known from the people next door that they're either fighting with, or they're having some religious problem with mixing their religions through intermarriage, and the prophets are saying, don't take wives of this group, don't take wives of that group. And they'll bring it over in the Hebrew Bible, and they'll change things so that Yahweh, the God of Israel, gets credit.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most well-known examples of this are Baal. Baal was the king of the gods under El in Ugaritic religion. And Baal was probably the biggest problem that the prophets faced.
Right.
The reason was that the religions were so close, but Baal was sort of the main character. Baal was very nasty, very evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't get the nickname Lord of the Flies for nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just not a nice character. And the prophets would take titles of Baal. My favorite one is the one who rides on the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll attribute that to Yahweh, to the God of Israel, as if to say, no, it isn't Baal who controls the heavens, it's our God. No, it isn't Baal who's the Lord of this, it's our God. They would take titles and little snippets of things that Baal was supposed to have done, and they'll put them on Yahweh. It's really a sort of a theological slap in the face.
Hmm.
That the prophets, they do this fairly frequently, and it's for deliberate theological get it right, you know, kind of emphasis in their own preaching and in their own books.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have this going on between the cultures, between the languages, between the nations. And when I tell people about the Divine Council, I say, look, the Israelites understood how to parse all this so that they weren't polytheists.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I like to put it this way. Yahweh is an Elohim, but no other Elohim or Yahweh.
Right.
Right. Right.
To put it in a more modern context, I guess you would look at the political structure of, say, the Irish of the Roman period, where you had a number of regional kings, but then you had the Most High King,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or the High King.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's no question as to who the Most High is.
Mm-hmm.
You have an odd sort of this I don't put in the novel. This is actually dissertation material. I put a lot of my dissertation stuff in plainer language and put it on my website, and people seem to enjoy it. But one of the neat things is that at Ugarit, you had El at the top. He was the sovereign. And then Baal was his sort of right-hand man, so mm-hmm. to speak. And Baal is the one that's actually called, though, Most High. Even though he's under El, he's called King of the Gods. Even though he's under El, what Baal was actually was what we would call a co-regent,
mm-hmm.
a co-ruler, someone who essentially runs the show. In Egypt, it would be the vizier,
mm-hmm.
the pharaoh,
mm-hmm.
someone who runs the show, but still is answerable to one other person. In the Old Testament, what they did, the Israelites did again. You can't very well have Yahweh being in El's place, or the God of Israel, and then like sort of hiring another God to run things, because that would be polytheism.
Mm-hmm.
So what you see happening is you have different, I'll call them manifestations, even though that's not a theologically precise word, but you have different manifestations of Yahweh himself, his own essence, in another character who basically plays the vice regent role.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things like, we're familiar with this from the New Testament, the Word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're familiar with that with John chapter 1.
Right.
That is actually not a Hellenistic Greek idea. If you go back to, I'm not saying every time the phrase "the word of the Lord came unto me" saying that it was a person, but there are passages where that's the case. Genesis 15, when God, you know, makes the covenant with Abraham,
mm-hmm.
the text actually says the word of the Lord came to me in a vision. It's not something audible. He sees something called the word of the Lord
okay.
that he perceives to be God. And then the covenant is made between them. Jeremiah 1, Jeremiah, same thing. The word of the Lord came unto me saying, and then they have this conversation. A few verses later, it says that Yahweh, the being there, reached out and touched me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something physical. It was a physical manifestation. You get it with the glory, okay, manifested as an independent mm-hmm. sort of being. The angel of the Lord is probably the most familiar one.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that he gets that title is because he is God's specific, I call him the special agent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He is the special messenger of Yahweh. The other ones, you know, the other angels get commanded by whoever's above them, but this one is different. And we know, we learn in Exodus 23 why he's different. God specifically says that this one is different because my name is in him. The interesting thing is, if you do a study of the word name,
mm-hmm.
the name itself was an entity in certain passages where the name would save Israel, the name would save David, the name would deliver this group, the name would enact judgment. It's really kind of odd, but if you know what to look for, you have the name, as though we're Yahweh, in a different form, in a different as a different being. And what's really cool is in John 17, Jesus thanks God for the name that has been given him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Revelation, mm-hmm. he has the name on his thigh.
Exactly. And we're all given a new name when we get
into
paradise.
Exactly. Whoever names the name of Christ. I mean, there are lots of real interesting theological connections that when you trace them back, this was a little tricky in my dissertation because I was in a department, my advisor was Jewish, and I argued in my dissertation that these, what you have here is you have Yahweh essentially taking his own essence. Now I'm using deliberate terms now. Think of the Nicene Creed.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh
mm-hmm.
takes of his own essence, and his own essence becomes a separate entity that is not autonomous, but is independent. So that other entity, the name, the angel, mm-hmm. the glory, the divine man in Ezekiel 1, you know, a whole host of these characters, it is Yahweh, but it isn't. It isn't kind of like Jesus is God, but he's not the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Just because he's not the Father doesn't mean he's God. Just because he's God doesn't mean he's the Father.
Mm-hmm.
You have this same sort of tension, but you have a being who shares Yahweh's essence, who is Yahweh in essence, but a separate being. I argued in my dissertation this was the seeds of binitarianism and really Trinitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it comes from. They didn't just invent this in the first century. You can
right.
actually find
right.
it in the Old Testament.
Right.
Right. And boy, that's a whole nother show right there talk about the true roots of Trinitarianism and Christianity versus the theories being thrown out there by the likes of Dan Brown over the last couple
yeah.
of years. We're talking to Dr. Mike Heiser, and this is MythArk Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert, and
this is Sharon Gilbert, back from the road.
And we've established that the host of heaven, that the nature of God and the number and variety of beings of the heavenly host is a lot more varied and complex than we imagined. This certainly has implications for what we 21st century humans experience today out in the world. And Mike, you've got some very, very interesting fields of study in addition to the ancient Semitic languages and the history of the ancient Near East. What implications do divine counsel have for people just trying to live their lives today, the spiritual battle or war, the
exactly.
struggle that goes on?
Why should the average Christian even care about this? Now,
let me, give you a couple examples,
yeah.
And then I'll give a kind of a quick summary. First one would be what I call the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Now, what that means is if you go to Deuteronomy 32, you look up verses 8 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
In most English Bibles, and some of the newer ones actually have this correct, New RSV and the ESV, which is a literal translation, has this correct. It'll say in verse 8 that when the Most High divided up the nations, we know when that happened. That was Genesis 10 and 11, the Tower of Babel incident.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When the Most High divided up the nations, he divided them up according to the number of, and most Bibles, English Bibles, will say the sons of Israel. However, the Dead Sea Scrolls and something called the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Old Testament done mm-hmm. prior to Jesus, will say, no, he divided them up according to the number of the sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the very next verse says, but Israel is God's portion. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. Now, what that means, here's the picture. Way back at the Tower of Babel incident, God, again, seeing that, you know, here we go again. We just had the flood. That didn't straighten out the disobedience problem.
Mm-hmm.
After the flood, he said, be fruitful and multiply, spread over the earth. They don't do that. I call this the Romans 1 event of the Old Testament, where God essentially gives humanity up to what they want. He comes down, sees what's going on at Babel, gives them different languages, disperses them throughout the world. And then you go to Deuteronomy 32 and you read what I just quoted
mm-hmm.
to you.
Right.
The picture's this. The God comes down and says, okay, look, you don't want me to be your God. That's pretty evident because you just don't obey. Fine. I'm going to give you what you want. You don't want me as God? Well, let me put you under the control of other gods. And so he divides up the nations, and each one of them is put under the domination, under the dominion. This isn't a blessing. This is a punishment
mm-hmm.
of one of the sons of God, who we found out in Psalm 82:6, sons of the Most High. They're also called Elohim.
Mm-hmm.
These are Elohim-level beings that are given administration of these other nations. And they become corrupt. They become worshipped by the people. You know, they're not God. They just become corrupt and they get judged for it. We don't have to go into the details here.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the Old Testament explanation for where the other nations get their pantheons. The interesting thing is, there was a strong tradition at Ugarit, you actually find this in tablets there, that the number of the sons of God were 70.
Oh.
Count the nations.
Mm-hmm.
In Genesis 10.
And guess who is enlisted?
Israel.
Israel is not listed.
Right.
So the reading sons of Israel makes no sense because Israel didn't even exist yet.
Right, okay.
Okay? So the correct reading is sons of God. It's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's in the Septuagint. You could accept it on those terms anyway, but just logically it doesn't make any sense. Well, you take that, and that is the beginning of really the rest of the Old Testament. From then on, what happens in the very next chapter, Genesis 12? God calls Abraham. No
mm-hmm.
reason other than I'm just going to pick this guy in Ur,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to start over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to create a new nation from him, from his descendants, his offspring. The rest of the Old Testament is nothing more than the story of God versus the gods,
right,
and Israel versus the nations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the New Testament, it changes. If you read Galatians 3, those of us who are believers in Christ, we become heirs of Abraham, joint heirs with him, and of the promises. This is why it transforms. It's no longer the story of Israel against the nations. It's the church against the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the picture that emerges from this passage, from Daniel 10, where you get, you know, quote-unquote princes who control geographical regions,
right.
Is that from the very beginning, it has been a cosmic kind of war between the forces of evil, those divine beings in the council who rebelled. And it isn't just the figure we call Satan. It's much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been an attempt to stamp out, to eliminate, to destroy the seed of humanity that God wanted to put the earth under from the very beginning, instead of the divine beings.
Dr. Michael S. Heiser will be presenting a conference on the theology behind the Da Vinci Code in Bellingham, Washington on April 22nd. Details are available at the website DaVinciCoda, C-O-D-A, DaVinciCoda.com. We'll put a link in the show notes. And you will want to either be there if you're in that part of the country, or you'll want to go to the website and pre-order one of the DVDs that will be recorded, because Mike has a teacher's heart. He'll lay out the information. It will be thoroughly researched, correct, and easy to digest.
Yep.
It's a lot of meat.
He's a very clear presenter.
Yes, he is. And he will give you the information you need to decide for yourself whether there is really anything to the Gnostic claims that underlie the plot of The Da Vinci Code, which is opening in May. The movie is coming out in May. Of course, the book has sold a gazillion copies. But we'll present the second half of that interview tomorrow with Dr. Michael S. Heiser. And, of course, we encourage you to go to his website and take advantage of the resources that he makes available there at michaelsheiser.com.
Well, I guess that wraps things up for today. We've got one more day this week, and that's going to be part two with Dr. Heiser. And in the meanwhile, we encourage you to give us your letters and emails and thoughts and well, rants.
Bouquets and brickbats.
Donuts. Send those donuts to donuts at... No, we don't have that address. We should have that address. Send it to radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And, of course, our forum, which is a wonderful place to interact with other people of like mind.
And a donut-free zone.
Yeah. She's flashing back on carbs. peeringintodarkness.com/forum. And, of course, the show notes are available at pidradio.com.
Well, I guess that's all for today. Until tomorrow, I'm Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye, everyone. Gonna step up to the microphone. Say hello.